Welcome to the Hinckley Institute of Politics. My name is Derek Deitch, and I will be the host for today's Hinckley Forum. This year, 2015, marks the 50th anniversary of the Hinckley Institute. The Hinckley Institute was established in 1965 through the generous bequest of the Nobel Foundation and Robert H. Hinckley. The Institute is dedicated to engaging students in government and the community and fostering a deeper understanding in the policies and the issues of today. The Hinckley Institute offers paid internships to students of all majors here locally in Washington, D.C., and in 55 countries around the globe. The Hinckley Institute also offers classes, the nation's only campaign management minor, week-long experiences to Washington, D.C., and over $700,000 in scholarships. We invite students to go next door or to our website, www.hinckley.utah.edu, for more information. The title of today's forum is Sexual and Domestic Violence, Politics, Policy, Possible Legislation, Including Appropriations, and is presented by Beta Theta Pi. Today's panel will be moderated by Holly Mullen. Holly is Executive Director of the Rape Recovery Center in Salt Lake City, the only independent nonprofit agency in the state to serve victims of rape and sexual assault full-time with 24-hour crisis intervention, advocacy, and professional mental health therapy. Holly also spent 30 years as a print journalist and has worked at the Salt Lake Tribune, the Deseret News, and other newspapers across the country. So join me in welcoming Holly Mullen.
Thank you so much, and thank you, Derek. Very quickly, the Rape Recovery Center and Beta Theta Pi here at the University of Utah have been in a very lucrative isn't the word, but fruitful partnership, and lucrative. They've adopted us as a philanthropy this year, and we've been working on some issues around sexual assault, especially as it applies to people on campus. And they are indeed men of principle, and we're very happy for this collaboration. Thank you again. I hope that before we begin today, I just wanted to take a brief opportunity. It made sense to me in this setting, the Hinckley Institute of Politics, to note the untimely passing of former House Speaker Becky Lockhart last Saturday. A series of memorials will be held for the late speaker over the next couple of days. But here at this institute, which really is the oldest, largest, and I think the most prestigious learning lab in the state in the ways of practical politics, it seems wholly appropriate for me to mention that the late speaker will long be remembered as a mentor, well, for many things, but particularly in this setting, I think as a mentor, especially to young women, in the ways of doing politics and doing constituent service. I know that as they saw her in her four legislative terms as speakers and wielding her gavel and managing legislation, that they can now say, I can do that too. To begin, the numbers about sexual violence in Utah really tell a difficult story. For one, the Utah Commission on Criminal and Juvenile Justice, in a 2007 statewide survey, found that one in three women over the age of 18 in Utah will be a victim of some kind of sexual assault during her lifetime. For men, it's about one in six. Also from that same study, 86% of female victims reported they were sexually assaulted for the first time before their 18th birthday in Utah. Only one in 10 victims will report his or her assault to law enforcement. And finally, rape is the only category of violent crime in which Utah's rate exceeds the national average. In other words, 69 of 100,000 females in Utah will report a rape, compared to 59% in the rest of the country. And we know the problem hits here on campus. Last year, at exactly this time, the Obama administration established a task force to examine the reality of sexual assault on college campuses and to address it. They learned then that one in four female students will be assaulted in some way during her college years. And we currently have a national effort that has grown out of that task force to really look across the country at the patchwork of policies and protocols on various campuses and how this is treated on campus. And it turns out that there are many different ways, and we're trying to find some uniformity in how we can deal with victims, reports, and in prevention. Today, for the purpose of our forum, in the past couple of years especially, the Utah legislature has addressed several sexual and domestic violence, I think, more concertedly than ever before. In 2013, for instance, after a decade of effort, House Bill 50, called the Dating Violence Protection Act and sponsored by former Representative Jennifer Selig, finally became law after 10 years. Last year, Representative Angela Romero's House Bill 286, Child Sexual Abuse Prevention, passed with wide bipartisan support, but it was a challenge. It was difficult. The legislature also found more than $750,000 in the last days of the 2014 session to help fund the testing of some 2,400 to 2,500 rape kits statewide that have been sitting in police evidence rooms waiting for attention and for analysis. So today we will look with our four panelists at what might be in session for the next legislative session starting next week. Quickly, by way of introduction, to my left and going down the row, Kim Fisher joined ABC Channel 4 in 2012. I hope that's right.
11.
Thank you. 2011 as a co-anchor on the weekday evening news. Kim prides herself on her versatility. She has done many human interest stories and is a native of Texas and has done worked at several stations in Texas. Most recently, Kim has done a lot of work around the issue of sexual and domestic violence, and that brings her with us today. We're looking forward to that. Welcome today, Kim. May I call you by your first names?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. Next to Kim is State Representative Angela Romero, who represents House District 26. That includes the near west side of Salt Lake City, the Glendale and Poplar Grove areas. Angela was elected in 2012 and will be beginning her second term next week. Among her many committee assignments, Representative Romero sits on the House Law Enforcement and Criminal Justice Standing Committee, which is very important to our discussion today. As I mentioned in the introduction, Angela's bill on child protection and sexual abuse curriculum in our public schools passed last year, and she's very interested in these topics, and welcome, Angela Romero. Next to Angela is State Senator Todd Weiler, a Republican from Woods Cross. He represents Senate District 23, which, if I'm correct, Senator, most of southern Davis County and a little bit of northern Salt Lake County. Rose Park area. Again, he serves on several committees. For the purposes of today's discussion, Senator Weiler is a member of the Social Services Appropriations Committee, as well as a member of the Senate Judiciary Law Enforcement and Criminal Justice Standing Committee. He also has sponsored a wide variety of bills, having come to the Senate in 2012, including a lot of ethical government and child protection legislation. Welcome today, Senator Weiler. Finally, with about 2.5 decades, I think, of prosecutorial experience, maybe more, Donna Kelly is currently an assistant Utah attorney general. Donna served as a prosecutor previously with the Utah County District Attorney's Office and has prosecuted numerous adult and child sexual assault cases. My association with Donna has to do with a grant she is currently working under from the U.S. Justice Department. In working with a team to provide training to police and prosecutors across the state on how trauma of sexual violence affects victims and how knowledge of that process can be brought to bear in police investigations and in courtroom practice. So welcome today, Donna Kelly.
Thank you.
Thanks. Well, if we can start, I think, with a look at what we've got coming ahead, and I'm going to start with Representative Angela Romero. Specifically, at this point, we know that you have introduced House Bill 74 for consideration by the legislature. Can you give us a little background on the bill? I know it's received some media attention recently, and let us know why it's necessary.
Well, House Bill HB 74 would just strike some language out of subsection 5 and subsection 6 in our consent. The definition of consent for sexual assault. After working on HB 286, Child Sex Abuse Preventative Education, and with Representative Selig leaving office sooner than we wanted her to, I decided to kind of champion some of her efforts, and this was an issue that's been very important to her and very important to me as a woman. And as somebody who's had friends who have been victims of sexual assault, child sex abuse, And I think sometimes that's not heard. When you look at our House right now, there are 10 women in office out of 75 in the House of Representatives. And of those, four of us are, and then you look at communities of color, you only have like four of us that are members within the House. And so I think what I do is I bring a unique perspective to the political process and that conversations that maybe some of my colleagues have thought about or maybe it hasn't impacted them the way it has myself. So I decided to run HB 74 because I've been working with a team of advocates from the Rape Recovery Center, UCASA, DeAndra Brown from the Five Browns. And this was an issue that was really important to them right now. The current code, it doesn't make sense. And so what we're doing is we're modifying it and bringing it up to the 21st century. So we're just striking some simple language.
And tell us, if you will, Donna Kelly, I can bring you in, and Senator Wyler as well. We have two attorneys in our midst today. But I know Donna Kelly has also been working on this with Representative Romero. First of all, when we're talking about consent, I don't know if everyone in the room understands how that works with regard to sexual assault. But what is it that we need to change in the current language around consent? And why is it important in your mind as a former prosecutor?
So thank you. I just wanted to say first, thank you for being here. Thank you for caring about these issues. I know this university is doing some wonderful work and groundbreaking work in the area of sexual assault. So thank you for what you're doing. I have been a special victims prosecutor. That includes domestic violence, sexual assault, and child abuse for the last 24 years, probably longer than most of you in the audience have been alive. Of course, I started when I was five, so not really. But as you go through these cases, these are the most difficult cases, in my opinion, that you can handle as a prosecutor because they're very emotional. They impact people's lives so dramatically. They cause so much damage. And we have begun to learn things about sexual assault and trauma and how it affects victims that we didn't know before. And that's why I think it's important for the law. You know, the law is a living, breathing thing and needs to be updated according to the knowledge that we have in our society. So with the particular consent statute that we have in Utah, there are 12 subsections that define what consent, lack of consent, means. The majority of prosecutions take place under subsection 1. I would say, just based on my own experience in Utah County, I was a prosecutor in Oregon, then I moved to Utah County and prosecuted there for 9 years. And now I'm doing training. But I would say 90% of the prosecutions I handled anyway fell under that first subsection. But the rest of the subsections in that statute are very important because in those types of cases, it's important to define clearly and set standards, not only for our society to be aware of, that these are the circumstances where we consider it a violation of the law. It's important to inform the community about these issues as well as providing consequences for people who violate those standards. In two of the subsections, there's language that is very difficult and confusing and virtually impossible to prove. The first one is subsection 5, which says that the statute reads, lack of consent is defined in Utah as, and then you drop down to subsection 5, the victim has not consented. That's the first phrase in that subsection. That doesn't make sense because we're reading this statute to identify what the circumstances are where victims don't consent. So it's very circular and very unhelpful for the statute to say lack of consent is defined as a situation where the victim hasn't consented. That makes no sense. And it goes on to say, which I think is the real important intent of the statute, is the victim hasn't consented and the victim was unconscious, unaware that the act was occurring, or unable to physically resist. So that's the real intent of the statute. But when you add this extra layer of, first you have to prove the victim hasn't consented, which, we don't know what that means in that particular phrase. And then you have to prove this extra stuff. It puts a double burden and, in my opinion, an impossible burden. If the victim is unconscious, how can the victim prove that she didn't consent? You don't know anything while you're unconscious.
Right.
Right? So taking that language out will clarify the standard for our entire state, and it will simplify things and make the burden of proof to the prosecutor very clear and make the defense give them better notice of what it is that they're charged with, what it is that they're responsible for. So in my opinion, it's tremendously helpful to clarify that subsection. And in the second subsection that Representative Romero is proposing some changes to, the intent of that subsection is to make it a crime to proceed with sexual activity with someone who does not have the, and the language says right now, because of a mental disease or defect, does not have the capacity to appreciate what's happening. That language, mental disease or defect, is a problem because, and I have spent many hours screening these cases as a prosecutor where I've had to call experts and talk to them and try to figure out exactly what it is about this person's ability that caused their inability to consent. Well, most defendants do not have advanced degrees in psychology, okay, or psychiatry, or medical degrees. They don't know how people's brains work or how the disease affected that individual. They can be held to a standard where they knew that this person was not appreciating, understanding what's happening, but went ahead anyway. But to put the extra burden on the state to prove that the defendant knew all about the disease, mental disease or defect, and knew that that resulted in their inability to consent, is a virtually impossible burden to prove. So removing that language and just requiring the state to prove that the defendant knew that the person was not able to appreciate what was happening and not able to resist it is a huge improvement. And it also, for defendants, for their rights, and to give them adequate notice of what they're charged with, it clarifies things tremendously.
Thanks, Donna. I wanted to skip quickly to Senator Wyler. So you're an attorney. You understand you've also been working on a lot on social service issues through the course of your legislation or your service in the legislature. How does this stand up for a defense attorney? I think that's what I've heard, some of the objections around this language change. And I think we'll say, oh, what's the big deal? It's only a couple of lines. But it seems to be very important. What do you think about that?
Well, I think it's a very important change, Ms. Kelly or Donna could tell you a lot better, but we actually have defendants, you know, who have said, she never said no. I mean, she's unconscious laying on the bed. Some of them were vomiting and unconscious and never said no, and the judges dismissed the cases because they couldn't prove lack of consent. And so I do think it's appropriate that we tighten that language. And when you say it's only a few sentences, every law is only a few sentences. And I remember my first semester of law school, and the professor put up, wrote on the board, a short section of the criminal code, and we spent 50 minutes talking about what each one of those words meant. And I'm like, oh, great, this is what law school is going to be like. But it got better. But, words have meaning. And, one of the criticisms that Representative Romero has heard about this bill is, well, it deprives the defendants of their due process. And I don't really understand that argument at all. I mean, you've got substantive due process, which lawyers will tell you is if someone's denied a fundamental constitutional liberty, well, that doesn't apply here to someone that's accused of forcing themselves on someone that's unconscious, etc. And you have procedural due process, which entitles a defendant to notice in a hearing. Well, if you're charged with a crime, you're going to have notice, and if you're in court, you're having your hearing. So I don't understand that right. defense at all. Real quickly, I remember the first time I ever heard the term ROFI, I think it was 1998, and I read a story from in Florida where a guy had gone to a bar and slipped something into a woman's drink, and she woke up a day and a half later, and her underwear was gone, and she could tell that, you know, she was painful in those areas, and I was shocked. I mean, I remember showing it to some other attorneys at my law firm, and some of them had teenage children. And I'm like, you should be aware of this. And now, Roe feed, everyone knows what it means to be mm-hmm. Roe feed, and there's movies that make jokes about it, and you know, it's part of our society, unfortunately. And I think it's more than time for the Utah legislature to address that.
Thank you. And one of the things we know, and I'm going to move to Kim Fisher here now, we know, again, a study that one of our sexual assault nurse examiners, Julie Valentine, she's also a professor at BYU, a nursing professor, looking at several hundred cases over the last 8 or 10 years, I think, in Salt Lake County. And of those cases, 15% of the victims reported being asleep or unconscious at the time of the rape or sexual assault. So we're not talking about, you know, crazy things that hardly ever happen. And we also know that perpetrators do go out of their way to pick very vulnerable people for their victims, including people with disabilities, mental disabilities, and people who are unconscious. Kim Fisher, you've done a lot of work around this, including talking to many, many women about how they're seen as sexual objects and how that all works into this topic. Can you chat a little bit about what you found?
Yeah, you sat there with me when I did a story back in November called In Her Shoes, and the focus was really sexual harassment, street harassment, catcalling, and then it actually took a step into, which I wasn't expecting, sexual assault. So I want to get interactive here because I see girls in the audience. Let's start with sexual harassment. That can be one of many things. Something as simple as a catcall, something as bad as a verbal threat of violence against you sexually. So you can just be walking down the street and someone says, "Hey, honey, your butt looks great in those pants," or a whistle. How many women have been made to feel uncomfortable walking down the street, walking through a bar? Raise your hand. Okay, now obviously this happens to men as well, but as Holly has said, one in three women are going to experience some sort of sexual assault in her lifetime. So obviously the burden is on women. So when I saw that number, when I started talking to women, when I heard their stories, I had a panel of 7 women, 8 including myself. We had all been groped in a public setting by a stranger. Like, that's incomprehensible for me. So I started looking into the why. Why does this happen to women? And a lot of the specialists I spoke with, including Holly, it's based on societal norms, right? So men are seen as more valuable than women. Women are sometimes seen as objects. I mean, look at any ad that's geared towards a man that has a woman in it. A lot of times you don't even see her face. You just see body parts because they're trying to sell this with sex. So what we really need to do as a society, we have to start with our children, and we have to let our kids know what's acceptable, what's not acceptable. We have to start teaching children respect at an early age. We have to start teaching children just what's right and wrong with women and men, because if we don't start there, then this perpetuates. Okay, so we're all adults in here, so you know that's not going to work for us. So what can all of us do? We need to step back and go, maybe the things we've learned about men and women and relationships isn't right. Maybe what's happening between that couple over there where she looks uncomfortable, maybe I should step in. Because most of us in this room are not going to assault somebody else. But the problem is that it does happen and we see it, or we think something might be going on and we don't say anything. That's what all of us can do, men and women. We can start stepping up and going, you know what? Are you okay? Because if you're not okay, you can come over here with me. Or if you're at a party, you know, all you college students, and you see a guy who's being a creeper, walk up and say, "You're being a creeper. Get out of here. Leave this woman alone." We all need to be more interactive with this in order for this problem to start to go away.
Thanks, perfect. Before I continue, I want to call attention to one of our friends and allies in the back room. Former Representative Jennifer Selig is here and has had great impact. Left the legislature at the end of last year to pursue her PhD, and she has been really, really instrumental in these kinds of topics that we're discussing today, including working very hard with a lot of support at the legislature in 2013 to pass it finally, after 10 years of work, a Dating Violence Protection Act, which makes it easier now for victims of dating violence, both sexual and domestic violence, to get protective orders to be safe as possible, we hope. And also really worked very hard to get the extra funding I mentioned in my introduction about the need to analyze all the rape kits that have been backlogged for so many years. So welcome. Do I call you former representative? But welcome. We're glad you're here. Senator Wyler, I kind of segueing a bit, because what we're talking about, I know we're kind of talking about assault against adults at this forum, but in regards to Representative Romero's legislation from last year, Child Sexual Abuse Prevention Act, maybe you can both talk about that a little bit, but I know, Senator Wyler, you were very passionate in your floor debate on the Senate floor about this topic. Do you feel like you can discuss that at all, and why you found yourself supporting it? So
I think the floor debate caught a lot of us by surprise in the Senate, and a lot of the people listening by even more surprise, because three male senators got up and described that they were, you know, various victims of sexual assault or attempted sexual assault, and I was one of the three, and I kind of got grouped in the category. I don't feel like nothing happened to me, whereas the other two, something did happen. My personal experience was I was at a Boy Scout camp when I was about 13 years old, and I was hanging out at the rifle and shotgun range, was working on that merit badge, and I'm Republican, so I like guns, you know. and the camp counselor and I were the only two there, and he asked me to help him clean up, and I did. And as we were, you know, getting ready to go, he asked me if he could take a picture with me, and I said, sure, you know, I'm an innocent 13-year-old. So he had one of these, you know, this was before the selfie. I know you guys, it's hard to relate, some of you students, but he had one of these cameras. I think he set it on the top of a fence post, and it had a self-timer on it. And he went, and he stood behind me, and he put his arms around my stomach, which, you know, I didn't seem to mind. I didn't know anything about. And then he asked me, he said, well, would it be okay if you took off your shirt? I'm like, sure. I mean, it was a camp. We went swimming all the time, you know, half the time. Took off my shirt, and he took a picture, put his arms around me and took the picture, and I got my shirt, put it back on, and went back to my tent, and never thought about it until about 4 years later. And I woke up one day, and I'm like, what the hell was that all about? You know, and I think that, I mean, that's all that happened. So I don't consider myself a victim of sexual assault, but obviously this man was grooming me. Maybe he was experimenting for the first time. I don't know how long he continued to work at that Boy Scout camp. This was outside of Utah. But I shared that experience, and I didn't know. I mean, I didn't, as a 13-year-old boy, I didn't know this was inappropriate. You know, it didn't even strike me as odd. And I remember it like it was yesterday.
Wow.
It didn't strike me as odd until I was more mature and looked back and thought that was wholly inappropriate. Okay. And so, yeah, and then Senator Thatcher and Senator Osmond shared much more graphic experiences, and, you know, I wasn't really a victim of anything except for maybe some grooming. So.
But I think it was really helpful, don't you, Representative Romero, in getting people to understand the level and the, I guess, the commonality of abuse against children, and how quiet we keep it. And maybe you can talk a little bit about your bill and what you hope it will accomplish now that it's passed into law.
Passed into law, so it'll be implemented in 2016. And again, I want to refer to Representative Selig, because when I first proposed this bill, she's like, do it, go for it. You're going to have some barriers, but try it. And everyone told me you're not going to be able to pass this piece of legislation. And I think with all the legislation she had passed prior to me coming on, it opened the conversation. And child sex abuse is something that people don't want to talk about. And that's the issue at hand, is that it's silent. And many times, and this goes with a resolution that I'll be running this session, it's called Start By Believing. And so that if you have someone come to you, whether they're a child or an adult, whether they've been sexually assaulted or have been a victim of human trafficking or child sex abuse, when they come to you and they share their story, you direct them to the right resources or you call law enforcement, because many times people who have been sexually violated will go to someone they trust, that person in turn will say, well, what were you wearing, or how did you act, what did you do? And so it becomes victim blaming instead of saying, hey, let's get you help. With working with HB 286, as I said, everyone said, you won't be able to pass it. You're a freshman legislator. This stuff never passes up here. And I'm like, watch me. And so what I did is I contacted people that I knew in the community. Deandra Brown from the Five Browns, her father had molested her and her sisters. I teamed up with the Smart family, Ed Smart and Elizabeth Smart, and Miss Utah had been a child sex abuse survivor. All those scenarios were very different, but the commonality was somebody had tried to take advantage of a child. And so by them meeting with my colleagues and sharing their stories, it opened their eyes, and they're like, wow, this can be my daughter, this can be my son. I had a male survivor there as well. And I think the most powerful thing out of this is I had a lot of adults who had never shared their story emailed me, call me, and then we were able to get them to the resources they need. So although this had happened to them in their childhood, by us talking about this piece of legislation, by it getting the media attention, it had triggered what had happened to them when they were young people. And so I knew even if the bill didn't pass, that people were going to get the help they needed. And so when it passed, and we had opposition, people were like, well, this is leading to sex education. Nothing to do with it. Teaching a child how to protect themselves is very, very different. But there's another important piece of this bill is when it comes to school personnel. And school personnel knowing what those boundaries are with students as well. And also giving information to families, to parents. If they don't feel comfortable with the piece of legislation, their child doesn't have to participate, and they can talk to them about it at home. But I think the biggest issue is people, when they think about sexual assault, they think about child sex abuse, they always think about a stranger. And in most cases, when a child's sexually abused, it's by someone they know. It's their uncle, it's their stepdad, their stepmom, their bishop, their priest. And so we need to give children those tools to say, hey, this is not okay. And we also need to give adults those tools to say, hey, if someone comes to you and shares this, you have to report it. I don't care if it's your brother or it's your husband. Your job is to protect that child. And so that, I think that was the most important piece of the bill. And that's what I see when we're dealing with HB 74. So many times we blame the victim. We don't give that person the opportunity to heal because we're like, are you sure? You know, well, maybe this or this or this happened. And then they remain silent. And then we deal with it in other ways. People abuse drugs, they abuse alcohol, or they do other destructive things, and that's passed on, and it's a cycle. And so by changing, like we said, simple language can empower so many men and women, because men are sexually violated as well. Mm-hmm. And I think so many times we focus on women, but men are also sexually violated, and I think it's important for them to know that they can get help as well, because we're, like you said, we're socialized to be a certain way. And many times when something happens, you don't want to say, well, that happened to me because I was weak.
Right.
And so we want to make sure that men feel like they have a voice too, and that they can come and they can talk to someone and be able to get the help they need as well. And so with HB 286, Child Sex Abuse Preventative Education, it opened the door to a conversation up at the Capitol. And I had colleagues who came up to me, and they decided to stay anonymous, but they're like, I was a victim of child sex abuse. You know, and so, or I had a sister, or I had a, everyone probably in this room is connected to someone who's been, but you as an individual have been a victim, or you're a survivor, or you are related to someone or know someone that's been a victim of sexual assault, whether it's as a child or as an adult. And so we always like to not have these conversations because they're so uncomfortable, but I think the more we bring it out to the forefront, the more people will become to watch out for other people, and if somebody comes to you, you get them the proper help. So that was the whole message behind the bill.
Excellent. And I can just add that we know, we do have research that the person who is on the receiving end of a disclosure from someone who's been sexually assaulted, whether that be a child or an adult, has absolutely just monumental power in terms of how that person may proceed either through the law enforcement process or through therapy. So the best thing you can do if someone comes to you and discloses that they were sexually assaulted is to say, it wasn't your fault, and I believe you, and if you want to get help, let's go get you some help. Make sure you leave it up to the victim, but please, please withhold judgment and be a good listener. Senator Wyler, you are sitting with the majority party, which is a great place to be at the Utah legislature. So how...
We're only like an 83%.
I know, it's just...
Don't blow it out of proportion.
Right, I will not. But how can we see with this coming session, of course, money is always an issue for everything. How do you see this session playing out, and how can people, for instance, in this room, especially with the Republican leadership, see that Angela Romero's bill gets passed, see that when appropriations bills come forward for sexual and domestic violence programs, that they get a fair shake and hopefully some decent funding? What's the best process for doing that?
Well, I think always the best process is to contact your own legislator, send them an email, and tell them that this is a priority for you and you'll be watching them. Don't threaten that, you know, don't threaten them. I get so many stupid threats. I mean, not physical threats, but if you don't vote for this. But, you know, come up to a committee and testify. We always, you know, almost always have public comment. And I remember the first time, I'm a lawyer, so I wasn't that into it. The first time I did that was back probably about 2000, 2001. And we have this weird dynamic in the Utah legislature where the legislator presenting the bill sits in front of the committee with a microphone. And then if you want to come up and speak on the bill, you sit right next to him. And I remember, and I'm going to share this, my very first experience, the first time I ever testified in front of the legislature on a bill, I had just gone up to watch, and they asked if there was public comment. And I had a comment, so I went up, and I sat right next to Becky Lockhart. And she was presenting her bill, and I testified against it. And I thought it was so weird I had to testify right next to her. And that was long before I ever served with her or became good friends with her husband. But come and do that. I mean, I think especially we're all of you. I was interested in politics at your age and much younger. But I think that those are the best things that you can do.
And I always say this whenever I talk to groups at all, the website for the legislature, if you don't know it, is here I go. Let's see, what is it?
le.utah.gov.
le.utah.gov.
And you don't need that www stuff.
Right, just le.utah.gov. And it's a really good website. It's an award-winning.
The legislature. It's the first two letters.
There you go. I mean, they are really on top of things. They update it all day and night, and it's very, very helpful.
We win awards every year. Yeah. It's the best legislative website in the country.
Really user-friendly. So keep on top of it, because you can follow a bill's progress, you can listen live, you can do all kinds of stuff. I want to make sure we have plenty of room for questions and comments, but I wanted to just quickly go to Donna Kelly again. Donna, in her work around the state right now, is really, really getting at some very fascinating and evidence-based research on what happens in a victim's brain when he or she is sexually assaulted. And I know it's a lengthy discussion, but can you talk a little bit about what that means, Donna, and why it is important in investigations and prosecutions?
Well, in January, a year ago, exactly a year ago from today, sort of a bomb exploded in the sexual assault world in Utah, and it was the Julie Valentine study with the National Institute of Justice. She's a BYU nursing professor. She studied cases from Salt Lake County, cases that had a sexual assault exam. A victim reported they were raped. They went in for a sexual assault exam, which is sometimes a four-hour lengthy process. And then she followed the cases from that point to the end of the cases, and she learned that only 6%, not 60, 6% of the cases were being prosecuted. And from a prosecutor's perspective, let me tell you, those are the good cases, because if I have a sexual assault report exam, I'm like high-fiving my fellow prosecutors in the hallway, because those are the good cases, right? We love medical reports. So only 6% were being prosecuted. That is not hugely different from the rest of the country. The rest of the country was about 8 or 10%. There's problems all over the country, but only 6%, which is dismal, which is horrible, which sent shockwaves through the law enforcement and prosecution communities. So I had had some training, and I'm trying to just tell this in a short time. I had had some training on trauma and how it affects people, and there were some huge, important studies that came out in 2010 from the National Institute of Justice and some other places that said, here's what happens when, here's how trauma affects your ability to perceive and to report events that have happened to you. And what had been happening all these many years is that police officers, when they sit down with a victim, it started with police officers, but it continued throughout the system with prosecutors, advocates, judges, and juries. When they heard the way the victim was describing it, when they heard that there were gaps in the victim's memory, they automatically went to, she must be making this up. She's making this up. Because if I was raped, I'd remember everything that happened to me, and I'd be able to tell it in a really cohesive narrative form. And so we perceived these abnormalities in the way that victims were reporting, and we attributed them to she's lying or he's lying. When actually they are, those abnormalities are the result of trauma. That's how trauma affects you. You're not going to be able to remember every single detail, most likely. You're not going to remember it in a narrative form, most likely. The peripheral details outside of the threat are not well remembered. So one of the trainings that I did about this subject, one of the detectives from West Valley City came up to me and he said, can we get a protocol on how to, you know, how to correctly interview people that have been through trauma? And I said, I don't know. I'll see if I can find one. So I called every national group I could think of, International Chiefs of Police, National District Attorneys Association. I called everybody. And they were like, no, 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 we don't have anything. So I called the detective back and I said, let's write a protocol. So we started the protocol. We wrote a protocol based on all this research about trauma. We implemented it May 1st of this of last year. And it's being studied again by the same person who did the National Institute of Justice study, Julie Valentine. It's being studied. And we are recording and transcribing every interview so that we can go through and figure out what worked and what didn't work and what the differences and what the successes are and what the failures are. And it has been hugely successful. We are hoping to go from 6% to at least 60% prosecution rate. I don't know what the final numbers will wind up being, but preliminarily, the numbers are very good. They're actually more than 60%. So, as we as a society and we as a state have to be willing to, you know, learn and listen to the scientists that are telling us things, listen to the way things, the new knowledge that is going to come on that will help us. And that was our effort to implement that. It's now being implemented. We just did a training for UPD, the largest law enforcement agency in the state. They have 450 officers. We trained every officer on trauma. We're doing training in Cache County. Their law enforcement agencies are all going to implement it, and we're presenting it at a national conference as well. But we have to always be, and again, it's so important that you're here to learn about this stuff and to, you know, the only way we progress on these issues is if we're willing to learn and willing to change. And so I think it's a lot of great things. That's just one thing that's happening in Utah right now. There's a lot of great things that are happening. And Holly has been at the forefront of a lot of them. We've done a lot of work on getting the backlog of rape kits tested. There's a lot of very exciting things happening in Utah. And Utah actually is in the position of being one of the leaders in the country.
Great.
On some of this stuff. On this trauma stuff, we are in the position of being one of the leaders in our country.
Thank you.
Because of this trauma protocol.
Thanks, Donna. That was great. And you did cut it.
Sorry.
There's so much. I know.
It's a 90-minute conversation.
So we're running short on time, and we want to make sure anyone with questions or comments has plenty of time. How are we doing this, Derek? Are you the guy with the mic?
Yeah. So the rest of the time we have for questions from the audience. If you have a question, go ahead and raise your hand, and I will bring you the microphone. Please state your name and major or wherever you may be from, and then speak directly into the mic.
Hello, my name is Preston. I'm a psychology major here at the U. As such, I have to thank you for that work in educating and training and making people more aware of the mental process.
You are most welcome.
As a survivor of domestic violence, I'd like to know what is or will be done. It sounds like you're all very aware and tuned in, but I'm very interested in what will be done to make people more aware of male victims of violence and assault. What's going to be done as far as making the prosecution of female perpetrators of violence a little bit more in line with the actual statistics of male and females being close to 50-50 as perpetrators of violence.
I think we're getting there. I think it's a shift in thinking. But you know, I'm from Davis County, and I was just reading an article this morning about this teacher from Davis High School. Altis is her last name, and you know, she was a teacher having sex with students, you know, male students at the high school. They're all the victims. And you know, I remember when I first started hearing these stories about, you know, female teachers having sex with male students. I mean, a lot of people around the cooler at the office would be like, oh, those guys were lucky, and they're probably high-fiving each other. But I do think that, you know, you're right. There is a bias there, I think, that is in society. But I think that culture is changing, and I think it'll continue to change. I don't know what we can do legislatively to force that change, but clearly that door swings both ways.
And that's why I tried to be inclusive when I was running legislation. I had a male survivor talking to individuals, and you'd be surprised some of my colleagues that are up there with me who want to remain anonymous that are also child sex abuse survivors. And when it comes to domestic violence, too, I think, like you said, it's the way we look at it, and then we have to kind of flip that paradigm, as you were mentioning, and talk about it from both sides, because we shouldn't allow a woman to be verbally or physically abusive and then say, well, we're not going to do anything to you if we have to hold that same standard for both men and women. So that's something I try to do anytime I'm talking about sexual assault, domestic violence, is ensure that it happens in both.
A couple of suggestions as someone who is a survivor. If you have ideas or think of things that would be great for our state, contact your legislator. Mm-hmm. Talk with your legislator. But aside from that, I think it comes right back to the societal norms we were talking about. A lot of reasons men don't want to step up is because they don't ever want to appear weak, because men are told they must be strong, they must be stoic, you can't show emotion, and that's all girly stuff, right? That has got to change, and we've got to change that starting with our children, so that if things like this happen to young men, they don't feel like they have to keep it in out of shame. Because the only way people are going to know if someone is being assaulted or hurt is if that person speaks up. And if a guy's afraid to speak up, then that just keeps going. So, yeah, I think it comes from society, and I think we all need to be open to becoming more emotionally intelligent.
And just so everyone knows, that we have a table out in the hallway with information about the Rape Recovery Center. We do have male services. We have therapists who work with males individually. We also have a male group that meets weekly. There's actually a waiting list, so I can speak to the truth of the numbers out there. They're definitely increasing as more men come forward.
Sorry, I have a quick follow-up. The current laws, the National Domestic or the National Violence Against Women Act, is gender specific. When it talks about the perpetrator, it always uses male pronouns. When it talks about the victim, it always uses female pronouns. And this is how law enforcement is trained. Would any of you support a change in legislation to make the language gender neutral?
I'd do a story on it.
Well, I mean, and so. Yes, but you need to understand, we're Utah state legislators, and you're referring to a congressional act, so you know, we would have to run for Congress to do that. I mean, I'm not saying that we couldn't advocate that to our congressmen and women, but it, you know, there is this bright line between, you know, federal and state, and we're state, and I get asked almost daily, well, what are you going to do about this? And I can't, you know, that's Congress. I can't change what Congress has done. But I think your point is well taken.
But I think even with our Start by Believing campaign, and hopefully that resolution passes, that's where we can start having those conversations. So it doesn't necessarily need to be gender specific. It can talk about just start by believing, you know, and anyone that's a survivor of sexual assault.
And again, I would suggest finding out who your congressman or woman is in your area and send them a letter. That's the kind of stuff that they'll grab onto and say, okay, is this something I can look into a little more? But it takes feedback from community, especially community members who have experienced it, in order to get legislators to act.
Okay, hi, my name's Samantha. I'm also a psychology major. The question I have is not from personal experience directly, but as a confidant for my friends who have come to me claiming to have been affected by some form of sexual assault, I was wondering to what extent is some form of action considered to be sexual assault. For instance, I have friends who say, oh, he kissed me and I didn't want him to. Is that a form of sexual assault? I'm wondering to what extent should we take more drastic measures in the protection of our friends?
Well, you know, we have some... If you want some really good reading, you can go to some sections of the Utah Code. We're very specific, and it's kind of genitalia related. So buttocks, between the legs, breasts, those are the areas that we kind of define that. So my guess would be, I mean, based on what you told me, if it was just a kiss, that would probably be very difficult to prosecute. But I also want to, you know, just say I think that the media. The movies, I mean, I saw a movie 2 days ago where, you know, it was basically teaching that every woman really wants a man just to, you know, just take her. And you know, I think the media gives us these false impressions. And I think pornography, which has become accepted and so prevalent on the internet, I think a lot of men are confused when they go out with a girl and the girl doesn't act like the girls do in those movies. And I think that it really is setting up some men for, you know, I'm really concerned about the effect that that's going to have as pornography continues to be, you know, setting these expectations for men and women that are just completely unrelated to how the real world works. And I'll get off my soapbox now.
Any views on that? I know, I mean, this is in part what we're doing partly with Representative Romero's bill is to look at more of an affirmative consent, a really strong consent statute. I'm not characterizing it well, but Angela or Donna, either one of you, can you talk a little bit about what we talk about with consent and with being assertive with
right.
Yes and no?
Well, I think the laws do two things. They provide consequences for people that violate them, but they also set a standard, and that's sends a message to people as to what's inappropriate behavior in our state. And so I think it will do both.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, this is what I tell people. I'm like, if somebody is unconscious, it's probably best that they're not in a place to have a sexual relationship with you. And so it's probably best and wise to walk away. Or if you see somebody that's passed out, that you're at a place, make sure that they get home safe. I mean, I think it's our responsibility, too, to not just be bystanders when we see something happening. I mean, I went to school here, too. I saw things. And sometimes we need to step up and say, hey, this is wrong, before a person gets put in that situation. Or if you're with a buddy or a colleague or a friend. And you see something going somewhere, it's our responsibility to say, hey, maybe this is probably not the right situation to be in. Let's get you home, or hey, we need to get her home. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think it's like you said, it's changing the culture of how we view sexuality and how we view what is consent. Because when we're talking about sexual assault or sexual violence, it's not really about consent. It's about power and control. And we tend to not look at it that way. And that's something we have to really look at. When someone's sexually violating someone or someone is hurting, doing something to someone that they don't have consent, it's not about pleasure. It's about power and control. And so we can't be bystanders and let that happen. We also need to step up and say, hey, this is wrong.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
So we have time for one more quick question. So we'll bring it right up here.
Oh, dear.
My name is McLean Taggart. I'm an accounting student, and one of the comments that was made was about how some of the resistance that was met with last year's bill that passed was that it approached sex ed. My question is, do any of you, this is open to all five of you, do you believe that there is a connection between sex ed or the lack thereof and the occurrences of sexual assault and violence?
Yes.
Good question.
Yes. I think when we're not discussing sexuality and consent and what happens behind closed doors, then it's left for us to assume. And what we find is that those assumptions get us in trouble, right? So I feel like having these types of discussions we're having right now, talking about what is consent. How do you know exactly what consent is if it's never been brought to you? How do you know what to expect if you're a young man and your, you know, parents send you out the door? Be good. Well, you know, what does that mean? I feel like the conversation has to be had in order for our young people to understand and be educated on the topic.
I agree. I mean, I grew up in a fundamental Catholic household. So sex, my grandparents raised me. Sex was, my grandma was like, Mother Nature takes its course. I'm like, what does that mean? And, you know, and as a mother of a son, I you know, we don't offer sex education in school. And he has his religious foundations. We practice our religion. But I sent him to Planned Parenthood, and they talked to him about his body. And those are the conversations he and I have. We have conversations all the time about what is consent, what isn't consent, what's appropriate, what's not appropriate. How do you treat women? How do you treat men?
So. You know, my first session in the Senate, the legislature passed an abstinence-only sex education bill saying that all that could be taught in the Utah schools is abstinence and nothing else. And the governor vetoed that bill, which I appreciated the veto, and there was no override, no attempt to override it. But sex ed is a hot-button issue in this state. And really what it comes down to, there's a lot of people and a lot of legislators who represent those people that believe it's a parent's sacred right to make those decisions, and it's not the proper role of government to take their kids and to tell them about the birds and the bees. And now I'm falling into those stereotypes. But where you draw those lines is difficult, and we struggle with that. And the views, I mean, probably just in this room would vary, you know, greatly. And so it's hard sometimes to figure out what is a parent's role, what is the government's role. And, you know, when I say the government, I'm talking about the school. And that's why it's such a hot-button issue.
Right. Mm-hmm. I agree with that.
And that's why it was a hot-button issue with our particular bill. And what we were discussing is not sex ed. We were discussing if someone's touching you inappropriately, that's wrong.
Yeah. And I don't know if it'll be the parents or the schools or whomever is going to teach young people, but our children need to understand and have these conversations, whether it be in the household, whether something changes in our schools. But we're not just going to learn it on our own. You know, we can't just get it through osmosis. And just because you tell children not to do it when they become young adults doesn't mean that they're not. So there has to be some sort of conversation wherever that conversation happens.
And that is all the time that we have for our panel today. Thank you for your questions. If you have any further questions, please feel free to talk to one of the panelists after, or as has been mentioned, you can contact your legislator or you can visit raperecoverycenter.org to find out more information. Please join me in thanking Holly and our panel for being here today. They all took some time out of their day to present this information, and thank you for coming today.